Shit is out of control down there. Lydia cannot discuss this with him. They are only bodies to him, strangers on the news, people like the ones he has killed himself. That girl in her quinceañera dress. But then Lydia's mind snags on a previous detail, an exit ramp. What happened to his daughter? She asks. Lorenzo looks confused, so Lydia clarifies. Javier's daughter, La Lechuza's daughter. You said it was sad. What happened to her? Yeah, you didn't hear? Hear what? What happened? On the day Sebastián's article was published, Javier read it in the backseat of his car, while his driver shuffled him through the sluggish morning streets of Acapulco. All his life, Javier had enjoyed an almost preternatural ability to predict incidents and their outcomes. When he was 11 years old and his father was diagnosed with colon cancer, Javier knew that death would be swift. He knew that his mother, who'd previously been a good mother, devoted and affectionate, would handle it poorly, that she'd medicate her grief with alcohol and new men. He foretold and accepted her abandonment well before it came to pass. As a result of that aptitude, Javier was almost immutably composed. Nothing ever really surprised him. So it was uncharacteristic that he failed to see the article coming. He wondered if his love for Lydia had blinded him to the inevitability of it, and that possibility caused him to feel a faint wrinkle of resentment toward her. Even before he read it, and even with the anonymous byline, Javier, who read the article with his usual equanimity, presumed the article was the work of Lydia's husband, whose journalistic expertise in the drug trade was well known. Initially, he didn't need to measure his response, because the article didn't provoke much feeling in him. On the contrary, Javier regarded it to be a mostly fair depiction of his life. There were, of course, some marginal inaccuracies, one or two instances of exaggeration. There was more righteous condemnation than Javier was prepared to accept, but that was to be expected. Beyond those details, Javier thought, Sebastián had managed to apprehend something true about the essence of Los Jardineros in Acapulco, and he was bewildered but unexpectedly pleased by the inclusion of his poem. Javier presumed that Lydia had somehow given it to her husband. Had she memorized it? A flattering notion. Secretly photographed it with her cell phone during a moment of lapsed judgment? Though the poem revealed something intimate about him, it also illuminated his humanity, he thought. He therefore portended that it might make him beloved by the people. He neither smiled nor scowled as he folded the newspaper and set it in the sunbeam on the leather seat beside him. Instead, he tried to anticipate the impact the article might have on his future. He understood immediately that there would be ramifications, that his relative anonymity was a thing of the past, that his liberty had been permanently compromised. He'd always known this would happen one day. He hadn't expected it to be so soon, but he would adapt. It was, at worst, a nuisance. Perhaps it could even be fun. He couldn't recall another time the press had devoted so much attention to a cartel as young as Los Jardineros. It had taken years of established work before ordinary people began to recognize the names El Chapo Guzmán or Pablo Escobar. And there were plenty of people who still loved those men for their generosity and mythos, even after their spectacular downfalls. The only thing that truly unsettled Javier was his speculation that Lydia, his dear Lydia, had betrayed his confidence with a poem. That betrayal he had not foreseen, and it caused a treacherous quickening in his chest. But then it occurred to him that perhaps she hadn't been disloyal at all. Maybe she'd provided the poem as a faithful contribution, a nod to his true self. Maybe the poem was a gift. Lydia knew Javier as well as anyone knew him. His first response to the article was exactly as she'd predicted. At the same moment, several miles away, just at the outskirts of the city on a sprawling finca with glittering all-day views of the turquoise sea, Javier's wife was also reading the article. She was a woman who had never been beautiful, but who took care to appear as if she might once have been. Her hair was platinum, her mascara and lipstick tastefully applied, her bosoms maintained by the architecture of expensive lingerie, her nails gleaming and square and only a shade pinker than natural. She hadn't had a cigarette in almost 3 years, yet here she was, smoke curling from the tip of her quivering menthol. She had a name, but she seldom heard it. Instead, she heard Mama or Mi Reina or Doña. She'd reached an age where she expected each day to be unveiling of some quiet new sorrow, and where she simultaneously believed there was nothing left in life that could truly surprise her. As she pursed her lips to draw on the menthol, the fine lines around her mouth became grooves. She stained the filter of her cigarette with a shimmer of gold coral lipstick and blew the smoke out over one shoulder. A nervous maid soundlessly approached and tipped extra coffee into her waiting cup. There were gulls out wheeling over the dappled blue horizon. The bougainvillea sang, but she sat, wordlessly, rereading Sebastian's article for the third time. It troubled her. It's unsettling to see, emboldened by the veracity of black and white, the most deeply suppressed grapplings of your own smothered conscience, printed right there in the newspaper for all the world to read. Javier's wife had failed to sufficiently calm herself when their daughter Marta called from boarding school in Barcelona later that afternoon and destroyed her with the simplicity of a single question. Mama, is it true? And because of her failure, in that moment, to adequately reassure her daughter, she would forever blame herself for what happened next. 3 days later, on the day before Jennifer's quinceañera, the boarding school dean called to relay the news that Marta had been found hanging from the air conditioning vent in her dorm room by a pair of her roommate's knotted tights. The suicide note was addressed only to her father. One more death should not matter much. Chapter 19. Just on the outskirts of Guadalajara, inhaling the fragrance of chocolate, Lydia stops dead in her tracks. Her hand flies up to her mouth. Lorenzo turns to face her.
Yeah, so I guess the daughter read the article your husband wrote, he says.
Oh my God, Lydia says.
You didn't know this?
Lydia's voice falters.
Yeah, somebody sent her the article, and when she read it, she freaked out and killed herself. Left her papi a suicide note.
Shit was ugly. That's why.
Lydia's mind races to put the pieces together while the boy Sicario talks.
That's why he went loco. Said you betrayed him, said your husband was responsible, said you were all gonna pay. He was really fucked up.
Wait, because her brain has ceased. It's too full.
Marta.
Isolated memories surge up in Lydia's consciousness, one after another, and then pop like bubbles. Javier in the bookstore, Skyping with his daughter in Barcelona before an exam, her apprehension, his fatherly encouragement. Javier laughing when he told Lydia about the pogo stick Marta bought him for his 50th birthday. How he tried it out just to please her and ended up with his back in spasms. Javier's insistence that Marta was the only good thing he'd ever done in his life.
Es mi cielo, mi luna, y todas mis estrellas.
My sky, my moon, and all my stars. There's an unwelcome pang in Lydia's chest.
She didn't know? She didn't know about her father, about the cartel?
I guess not.
How could she not know? It seems so unlikely, but Lydia immediately perceives her own hypocrisy. She hadn't known either. The first domino of her understanding teeters and falls.
Lorenzo shrugs. I don't know, but he made your family like a straight-up vendetta. It was practically a press release for Los Jardineros. Usually when there's a job, you only hear what you need to hear, and it's only the people involved who know anything about it. But this time was different. Everybody in the city knew. Everybody in Guerrero.
Lydia begins shuffling her feet beneath her again, but her mind is whirring like a disengaged motor. She is blindsided. All this time, all these miles, the same futile, idiotic refrain kept presenting itself through her thoughts. This wasn't supposed to happen. It wasn't supposed to happen. She'd misjudged him. She had missed something. A thousand times she'd replayed the conversation she'd had with Sebastian the night before the article came out. He'd asked if they should go to a hotel for a few days to be on the safe side. No, I think we're fine, she'd told him.
100%?
Yes, she said. 100%. How that answer has haunted her. It has followed her into sleep every night. It has twisted in her gut without reprieve. All the frivolous reasons she hadn't wanted to go to the hotel. She hated to uproot Luca, for him to miss school, for her business to suffer. She hated the interruption to their routine. And she'd believed, truly, that Javier wouldn't hurt them. What she wouldn't give to go back to that moment with Sebastian, to say anything else. To suck those words back in and obliterate them. 100%, she'd said. How presumptuous she'd been. How foolhardy. Of course she couldn't account for every eventuality. Why hadn't she seen that sooner? She could never have predicted this, but she could have predicted that something unpredictable might happen. Why? Her body feels like cracked glass. Already shattered and held in place only by a trick of temporary gravity. One wrong move and she will come to pieces. Marta's death changed everything, of course. It changed everything. Behind her shock, Lydia can sense waves of competing emotions, but she shuts them all down. De ninguna manera. She will feel nothing about Javier's dead daughter. No. Lydia will not even say her name. She will feel nothing about his anguish. The note he sent her at the Duquesa Imperial. I'm sorry for your pain and mine. Now we are bound forever in this grief. No. No. His grief is not the same as hers. Lydia will not feel empathy for him. She will rage. She will inhabit the fury of her own senseless bereavement, the one that Javier invented for her. Instead, she will walk. She will leave him behind. She will repeat the 16 names of her murdered family. Innocents, all of them. Sebastian especially, an honorable man doing his job. She will list them and repeat them and remember. Sebastian, Yemi, Alex, Jennifer, Adrián, Paula, Arturo, Stephanie, Nico, Joaquín, Diana, Vicente, Rafael, Lucía, and Rafaelito, Mamá. Repeat. Her husband, her sister, her niece and nephew, her aunt, her two cousins, all their beautiful children, her mamá. Lydia will not stop saying their names. Lorenzo is saying something beside her, but his voice recedes behind her own recitation. She needs to be away from him. She will walk beside Luca instead, press his warm fingers into the palm of her hand. Her repetition will become a prayer.
They pass into busier neighborhoods with curious dogs and kids riding bikes and women pushing strollers. Luca sees one man with a white cowboy hat riding an old pony and talking on his cell phone, which makes him laugh. There are also girls who look to be around the sister's age who stand near the tracks in groups of two and three. They wear clothes that look like mommy's underwear and white high heels or knee-high boots. They have neon pink lips, and they call out to their countrymen in their Central American accents as they walk past. The girls invite the men to come have a beer or a smoke or a rest, and Luca knows there's something off about their appearance, their dress, something improper about their posture, so languorous against the bustle of the day. But he doesn't understand how it all works. He doesn't understand the difference between the men who shake their heads sadly and avert their eyes, and the ones who leer and whistle, who trot off to disappear into darkened doorways with those young dress-up girls. When he tries to ask Mommy about them, she only shakes her head and squeezes his hand. Several times they pass clusters of uniformed men who rouse themselves when they notice the passing migrants, but each time this happens, Danilo removes the steel-sheathed machete from his shoulder and swings it along his body as he walks. He does some elaborate shuffle that passes for a dance and sings as they go. Guadalajara, Guadalajara, tienes el alma de provinciana, hueles a limpio a rosa temprana. When the men in their uniforms notice him, they return their interest elsewhere. So by the time they reach La Piedrera, Lydia feels as though Danilo has saved their lives perhaps seven times. She grips his hand and says thank you, but he shrugs it off and wishes them a safe continued journey. He turns and ambles back down the tracks the way they came. They hear him singing as he goes. Guadalajara, Guadalajara, sabes a pura tierra mojada. I wish he could come with us all the way to El Norte, Rebecca says to Soledad as they watch him go. I can take care of you, Lorenzo says in response. The sisters turn to look at him. Nah, we're all set, Rebecca says. Thanks. Lorenzo shrugs, but Soledad has no patience for this cholo and has never been a champion of subtlety anyway. She wheels on him. Are you still here? Did we invite you to join us or something? Because I don't remember doing that. Damn, girl, cálmate. We're all going to the same place, aren't we? Are we? I mean, what, you own Guadalajara now? She turns away. Come on, she says to Rebecca. The girls start to walk, and Luca with them. Lydia doesn't move. She knows Lorenzo could use that phone in his pocket to call Javier right now. He could snap her neck and then snap her picture, collect a big reward. Her death could make him a jardinero's hero. But isn't it possible that, beneath the shield of his baby narco swagger, he's also a scared boy, alone in the world and running for his life? And isn't it also probably true that if he persists in not murdering them, he might know more things about the cartels that could help them? He's already been a wellspring, and Lydia would like the chance to interview him further, to pump him for more information. Luca and the girls look back at her from the corner they're about to turn. Luca is holding Rebecca's hand. The pace of their life has become so fast and so slow. Lydia never has enough time to make decisions. She works from instinct alone, and her instinct is strong in this instance. It tells her to go, to get away from him. Can I ask you one thing? She says. He shrugs. Do you think he's still looking for us?
Sin duda alguna, he says.
Without a doubt. It's not surprising, but still, there's no comfort in the validation. Her body feels leaden. But we're safe here, yes? Lorenzo's wearing a string backpack. He squints and looks around. I don't know, he says. I mean, anywhere is safer than Acapulco.
But he has alliances in other plazas?
Claro que sí. There's a lot more cooperation with the other cartels than there was before him. He's got reach, deep into rival territories.
Which ones? She asks.
I don't know. What do I look like, some kind of maldito expert? Well, yes, she thinks. She moves her lips to one side.
I'm just trying to determine our safest route.
There is no safest route, far as I can tell, he says. You just gotta run like hell.
She looks into his face, broad and young. His eyes are heavily lidded, his upper lip softened by a feeble crop of hair. He has the remnants of a breakout high on one cheekbone. He's a veritable kid who has murdered at least 3 people.
Lorenzo, you're not going to tell anyone, are you? She asks.
She tries to anchor his gaze, but he looks away.
Nah, I told you already. I'm done with all that. I'm out.
He jams his hands into the pockets of his shorts. She nods skeptically. Thank you.
Ni modo.
It's an effort to turn her back to him, because she is still afraid. The shock of a blade entering her flesh, severing her spine. The pile of her body in the road beside the tracks.
Suerte, Lorenzo, she says,
and she turns to go.
It's even harder not to look back after she rejoins Luca and the sisters, but she knows he might interpret any backward glance as a weakness or an invitation. So she only imagines him falling behind. She pictures him following from a hidden distance, but she doesn't turn to confront her suspicions. She keeps moving, adelante, keeps Luca and the girls moving. It's not until hours later, on the doorstep of a migrant shelter, that she accords herself a pause of reassurance. Just before she enters, she turns and allows her gaze to sweep up and down the vacant road, to linger and search in every shadow, and to thank God. He is gone. They're exhausted by the time they arrive. There are good migrant services in the city, and between that and Danilo's modest heroics, the Hershey's kisses, Luca has difficulty reconciling all the genuine kindness of strangers. It seems impossible that good people, so many good people, can exist in the same world where men shoot up whole families at birthday parties and then stand over their corpses and eat their chicken. There's a frazzling thrum of confusion that arcs out of Luca's brain when he tries to make those two facts sit side by side. At the shelter, Rebecca and Soledad stand guard for each other outside the bathroom door. It's a luxury to slough the dust of the road off your skin, to soap up and stand beneath a spray of warm water, to watch it pool at your feet, grimy and brown, before it circles the drain and disappears forever. Soledad likes to think of the water molecules racing down the drain pipes, intermingling and dispersing, joining other pipes beneath the streets of the city, gathering volume and speed as they rush and tumble toward some unknown destination. She likes to think of the filth she washes from her skin, diluted and diluted until it no longer exists as filth at all. Although Soledad has a cell phone Ivan gave her, she can't use it to make phone calls or text because it has no credit. If it did have credit, Soledad still wouldn't use it. For 2 reasons. First, except for her primo Cesar, no one she knows has a cell phone anyway. And second, like Lydia, she's afraid that if she uses the phone, Ivan will then somehow be able to find her. So the phone functions mostly as a repository of photographs, but also as a propeller that reminds Soledad how far she has come and how much better her life will be when she gets to El Norte. So when, after their showers, the director of the casa asks them if they'd like to use the communications room to email or call anyone, the girls' excitement is almost too much to articulate. Finally, they can call Papi.
Rebecca has never used a phone before, never lifted a device to her ear and heard the familiar voice of a faraway loved one. Soledad has never initiated a call. It's an ordinary modern convenience that, for the sisters, still carries the full weight of the miraculous.
How do we do it?
Rebecca asks her sister after the director has shown them into the quiet room and closed the door behind them. Soledad frowns.
Get Luca.
The room is small, and it contains a desk with a glowing computer, one rolling office chair, and a small floral print couch. The phone sits on the desk beside the monitor. Rebecca returns quickly with Luca, who sits down at the computer, asks the sisters for the name of the hotel where her father works, and finds the phone number within seconds. He writes it down on the lone yellow notepad, but when he stands to go, Soledad asks him to dial it too.
What's your father's name?
He asks, covering the mouthpiece as the line rings in his ear.
Elmer,
Soledad says. Ask for Elmer Abarca Lobo in the main kitchen. So Luca does, but as he prepares to immediately hand the phone over to Soledad, the receptionist says,
I'm sorry, but Elmer isn't working today. Hold on.
Luca hears the sound of her voice, muffled for a moment before she returns to speaking clearly.
Can I ask who's calling?
She says.
I'm here with his daughters. I was just putting in the call for them.
I see, she says.
Hold on, I'll put Soledad on,
Luca says. He hands the phone to Soledad, who takes his seat, her face brightening in nervous anticipation. She hopes Papi won't be angry with them. She hopes he'll understand why they had to leave the way they did, without warning, without a proper goodbye. She's been haunted these last weeks by the thought of him coming home alone to the dark apartment, exhausted from a double shift, and finding her note. She's tried not to think about the anguish it might have caused him. She bites her lip.
Hello?
She says.
Hello?
A woman's voice on the line, still the receptionist. You're calling for Elmer? Is this Elmer's daughter?
Yes, it's Soledad. Is he there? May we speak with him?
I'm afraid Elmer's not working right now, Soledad. Soledad's shoulders slump, and she leans back in the chair.
Okay,
she says.
Can we leave a message for him? It's an important message, and I don't know when we'll have an opportunity to use a telephone again. I'm here with my sister, Rebecca, and we want to tell him we're okay.
Soledad, the woman says. Just that. Just her name. Soledad. But something about the hesitation in those three syllables makes Soledad's stomach drop. She straightens up in the chair. I'm sorry, but your father won't be back to work for quite some time. Soledad grabs the edge of the desk and turns her back to her sister. Luca reaches for the doorknob, but Soledad puts a hand on his shoulder. Her mouth is open, but she refuses to ask the questions that will lead to her enlightenment. She doesn't want to know. I'm sorry, Soledad, but your father had an accident. Not an accident. Your father, he's in the hospital. Soledad clamps her knees together and stands up, sending the chair rolling away behind her.
Why? What happened?
Rebecca stands up then too, and Luca moves next to her.
Is he okay?
Soledad asks. The woman's voice is low. I think he's stable. That was the last we heard. Soledad takes one breath. Stable.
But what happened?
He was attacked coming into work last week. She moves to collapse into the chair again, but the chair is no longer behind her, and she almost falls to the floor. Luca grabs the chair and rolls it over. She sits.
He was stabbed, the woman is saying. I'm so sorry.
Which hospital?
El Nacional. I'm sorry, Soledad.
Soledad hangs up the phone, and it takes Luca less than 1 minute to find the number for the Hospital Nacional in San Pedro Sula. Again, he dials for them, but this time he hits the speakerphone button so they can all hear. And 1,360 miles away, in the ICU unit in a 6-story green and blue building, a nurse wearing clean white scrubs and a blue stethoscope darts into the nurse's station and tosses a chart onto the cluttered desk. Luca, Rebecca, and Soledad all hear her pick up the phone. They lean forward. "I think my father is there," Soledad says. Her voice sounds swollen and cobwebby in her ears. "My father, Elmer Abarca Lobo, the woman at his work told us he was there since last week." They can hear things clicking and beeping in the background, voices, a child crying. The nurse does not immediately reply. "Hello?" Rebecca says. "I'm looking," the nurse replies. There are folders, charts. She's flipping through them. Soledad's hand darts over and grabs her sister's across the desk. Together, their knuckles turn hard and shiny. "A woman at his work told us he was stabbed." "Oh," as if the nurse suddenly remembers. "Yes, Elmer," she says. "He's here. Not in great shape, I'm afraid, but he's stable now. He lost a lot of blood." Rebecca clamps her free hand over her mouth. Soledad digs her fingers into the skin of her face, her lower jaw. "Can we speak with him?" "No, he's not conscious," the nurse says. "Can you come in?" Rebecca shakes her head, but Soledad answers out loud. "We're not in Honduras," she explains. "We're in Mexico." Rebecca is stuck on a different detail. "What do you mean he's not conscious? What does that mean?" "It means we have him sleeping right now because of the damage to his brain. He needs to sleep until the swelling and trauma are under control." Soledad pitches forward, curling her body over her knees. "Damage to his brain?" Rebecca says. "I don't understand." "Yes," the nurse says. "He was stabbed in the face." "Oh my God," both girls begin to cry. Luca is shifting his weight ever more rapidly from foot to foot. He backs away from the phone until he's leaning against the wall beside the door. "He was stabbed once in the stomach and twice in the face," the nurse keeps talking. She's not oblivious to the sister's pain, but she knows she has to impart this information, and it's better to do it quickly, like ripping off a Band-Aid, so they can move on to the next part, where they already know all the awful information and can begin to process it. "The stab wound that did the most damage was the right-hand side of his infraorbital region." "Infraorbital? What is that?" asks Soledad. "Please speak simply." Even the most hardened trauma nurse in the most violent city in the world would have difficulty conveying this detail to the family. "His eye," she explains. "They stabbed him in the eye?" Soledad asks. "Yes," the nurse says. "Oh my God," Rebecca says again. "Yes," the nurse says. She tells them he's resting comfortably, that he's stable, that they will keep him in the medically induced coma until the doctor feels it's safe to wake him up. She doesn't know how long that will be. She warns them that the stab wounds were significant and that there may be lasting damage to his brain. She explains that there's no way to assess the damage until the initial period of rest and healing has concluded. "Girls," the nurse says quietly, and they hear a door close on her end of the line, followed by a peripheral silence. "Do you know who did this to your father?" Soledad lets out a sob and then answers, "Yes, I think yes, I do." Rebecca's black eyes grow even larger and darker, a storm in her face. "Listen to me," the nurse says. "I need you to listen carefully." Both girls breathe raggedly. They are shaking. "Don't you dare come back here," the nurse says.
Don't even think about it. Do you hear me? Their faces are wet, their noses filled with snot and tears. Rebecca sniffs loudly and lets a small cry loose into the room. He's getting the best care possible, okay? The nurse says. There's a catch in her voice, too. We are doing everything we can to make him well again. And if you come back here just to sit in our waiting room and wringing your hands and cry and get yourselves both stabbed in the eye, too, well, it's not going to do him one bit of good. You understand? They do not answer. How old are you girls?
15,
Soledad says. 14,
says Rebecca.
Good. Your papi wants you to live until you're 100 years old, okay? You cannot do that if you come back here. Keep going. In San Pedro Sula, at the Hospital Nacional, they can hear the nurse blowing her nose. My name's Angela. Call me again next time you get to a phone, and I'll give you an update.
Thank you, Rebecca says.
The nurse clears her throat.
I'll tell your father you called.
After they hang up, they stay in the room without speaking. Soledad stands up and sits down and stands up again at least 10 times. Rebecca sits on the edge of the couch and shreds a Kleenex into pulp. Luca does not move. He hopes the sisters will forget he's there. He hopes they won't speak to him or ask anything of him. He needs to get out of this room but cannot move. His papi is dead. Luca lifts a hand to touch the red brim of his dead father's hat. He pictures papi on the back patio of Abuela's house, without nurses or blankets or beeping machines that might save him. He pictures the silence of pooling blood. Luca stands there and blends into the wall. Soon, there's a knock on the door. Soledad is grateful for the knock, as it gives her something outside her body to attend to. She opens the door. About finished? A staff counselor stands in the hallway with another migrant. There's a 15-minute time limit when people are waiting.
Yes, sorry, Soledad says. We'll be right out.
Luca slips out just before the counselor closes the door. Inside, Soledad whispers,
I'm sorry.
What? Rebecca looks up from her tormented Kleenex.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. It's my fault, Rebecca. Forgive me.
Rebecca moves swiftly across the small space and throws her arms around Soledad so her rainbow wristband presses against the still wet blackness of her sister's hair.
Shh, she says. It's all my fault, Soledad says over and over again, until finally Rebecca pushes back from her and shakes her roughly by her two shoulders. Don't be ridiculous. It's no one's fault. Only ese hijo de puta.
Soledad crumples even smaller into her sister's arms.
But I had to make a horrible choice, she cries. It was you or papi. I knew that. I knew we were putting him in danger if we left. Ivan warned me. I didn't really think he'd go through with it. I thought if we left, he...
She doesn't bother finishing the sentence, because it doesn't matter what she thought. She was wrong. The sisters take 2 shaky breaths together, and Rebecca wipes Soledad's tears with her thumbs.
Stop, Rebecca says. Stop it, Sole. Papi would have made the same choice. When he's better, he'll be proud of you. You'll see.
Soledad dries her face with a fresh Kleenex. She blows her nose.
You're right.
He'll be okay, Rebecca says.
He has to.
Into the clicking, beeping silence of Papi's hospital room in San Pedro Sula, the nurse Angela enters solemnly in her white sneakers. She had known his name, of course, because of the identification they found in his wallet. But there have been no visitors, no inquiries, until today. Sometimes it's easier that way. You can provide the care the patient needs,
manage his pain and administer to his broken body without the weight of additional sorrow. Angela has been a nurse in this city long enough to know that the pain of the family often eclipses the pain of the patient. It's relatively quiet in the ward this evening, so after she checks his vitals and changes his waist bag, Angela has time to sit with him. It's still light out, but she turns on the table lamp anyway, because she finds its soft glow comforting. She closes her eyes briefly before she speaks to him. Her colleagues don't do this anymore, because it's too taxing, too heavy. Angela is the only one. The violence is overwhelming in this place now. It's become a gang pageant of blood and grisly one-upmanship. The ICU is always busy, but it's not as overcrowded as the morgue. The other nurses use irreverent humor to cope. They use a secret rating system of smiley faces to forecast the patient's chances of survival. Angela doesn't judge them for it. They have to go home to their children at the end of their shifts. They want to stay married. They want to eat dinner and drink a beer in the yard with their neighbors. But after 20 years on the job, Angela still can't shut it off. She doesn't even want to. She pulls the chair closer to Elmer's bedside and lifts his hand, careful not to disturb his IV line. She rubs the back of his hand with her thumb. "Elmer, your daughter's called today," she says quietly. "Soledad and Rebecca called from Mexico, and they're doing well, Elmer. Your daughters are okay. They're on their way to El Norte."
Chapter 20. Later that night, when the initial wash of shock has lost its bite and the sisters are beginning to feel calm beneath the new distress of the terrible news, Lorenzo shows up at the shelter. Lydia is helping in the kitchen, stirring a huge pot of beans on the cooktop, when she sees him through the open door to the large dining room. From a distance, he's not as menacing as he'd appeared on the train. He's not as tall, not as bulky as his first impression would have suggested. Like every other migrant here, he looks bone-weary and relieved to be indoors where the aroma of a hot meal greets him. Still, Lydia instinctively moves her body out of his line of vision and accidentally drops the long wooden spoon into the vat of beans. "Carajo!" she says out loud. She presses her eyes and mouth closed for just a moment, and when the woman who runs the kitchen notices, she tells Lydia not to worry and hands her a pair of tongs so she can fish the wooden spoon out of the beans. Lydia helps serve the dinner too, on paper plates, and the migrants have to line up cafeteria style for their food. When Lorenzo comes through and Lydia ladles a spoonful of beans onto his plate, he nods at her without making eye contact, without further comment, and that strange behavior makes Lydia even more afraid. Has she offended him, provoked him to change his mind about letting them be? "Would you like a little more?" she asks him, but he's already moved along to the rice station. The sisters and Luca are behind him in line, and while they're waiting, Soledad feels a hand slip beneath her arm and grope her breast. It's so fast, like a sparrow. Her whole body recoils from that hand, but when she whips her head around to confront her offender, there are three migrant men all standing there facing one another. They're so deep in conversation and so oblivious to her presence that there's no way to determine who it was that grabbed her. Their disinterest is so convincing that Soledad finds herself wondering if she imagined the violation. "No," she tells herself, "I am not crazy." She grinds her teeth and clamps her arms in front of her. She keeps her body hunched into a warning. After dinner, everyone gathers in La Sala to watch television, but not Lorenzo. Lydia doesn't know if she's relieved or concerned about his absence. It's both. She wants to keep an eye on him and hopes to never see him, ever again. On TV, no one wants to watch the news because it's all too familiar, so they put on Los Simpson. At home, Mommy doesn't like Luca watching Los Simpson because she thinks Bart is rude, and she doesn't want Luca to start saying things like, "Cómete mis calzoncillos." But what Mommy doesn't know is that Luca and Papi used to watch it together all the time when she wasn't home. And Papi would stretch out on the couch with his shoes off and his toes wiggling in his socks. And Luca would drape himself across Papi's chest like a blanket. And Papi would rub Luca's back while they watched. It was their secret ceremony. They'd imitate the voices, and Papi would keep the remote control close by, so if Mommy came in unexpectedly, he could change the channel to Arte Ninja real quick. Luca doesn't like watching Los Simpson here in this tiled room with its fluorescent lights and everyone sitting on folding chairs with their arms crossed and their shoes on. He endures it by unlacing and relacing his sneakers 3 times, and when it's over, Mommy suggests to Soledad and Rebecca that they might all say a rosary together for the full restoration of their father's health. Also, she knows the practice will serve to calm her nerves, to soothe her agitation before she attempts to sleep. They retreat to the corner of the room where the tables are, and several other women join them. The sisters are grateful, and it's the first time in Luca's life that the rosary doesn't feel like a chore. He listens to the chanting voices of the gathered women, first his mother's lone cadence. "Blessed are you among women." And then the chorus of response. "Pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death." Amen. Otra vez. Luca holds his abuela's blue stone rosary in both hands, and he counts out the prayers. He squeezes the stones between his fingers so hard, their shapes are temporarily etched into the press of his skin. He wonders if Abuela ever did that, wonders how many times she passed these stones through the grasp of her aged hands. And when that thought occurs to him, he can nearly hear Abuela's voice among the chorus, "Santa María, Madre de Dios." There's a catch in his throat, so he can't speak, can't add his own voice to the prayer. But it's okay, because listening is its own kind of reverence. And in any case, he feels an energy flowing out of the beads and into his fingertips like a throb, like a heartbeat. The rosary is a kind of tether, and if he clings to it tightly enough, it will preserve his connection to Abuela and Adrián, to all of them. To Acapulco, his little bedroom with a balón de fútbol lamp and the blanket with the race cars on it. To home. Luca closes his eyes and listens to the chain of prayers that binds him to Papi. All the while, there's a new posture about the sisters that slouches them into a diminished curl. When Luca opens his eyes and emerges from his own thoughts, he recognizes that posture because it's familiar to him. It's relatively new to Mommy, too, and Luca thinks of it as a grief curl. He feels truly sorry for the sisters' anguish and for Mommy's, so he asks God to alleviate their suffering. That night, Luca sleeps the best kind of sleep. He sleeps without dreaming. That Lydia and Luca will travel with Soledad and Rebecca for as long as possible has not been detailed aloud. Yet, it's an arrangement all four of them intuitively understand. So much has happened that each hour of this journey feels like a year. But there's something more than that. It's the bond of trauma, the bond of sharing an indescribable experience together. Whatever happens, no one else in their lives will ever fully comprehend the ordeal of this pilgrimage, the characters they've met, the fear that travels with them, the grief and fatigue that eat at them. Their collective determination to keep pressing north. It soldiers them together, so they feel like an almost family now. It's also true that selfishly, strategically, Lydia hopes the addition of 2 extra people to their traveling party might serve as an extra layer of camouflage, might confuse anyone who, at first glance, suspects she might be the dead reporter's missing widow. Before sleep, Lydia closes the ugliest box in her mind and instead allows herself to think forward to Estados Unidos. Instead of Denver, she thinks of a little white house in the desert with thick adobe walls. She's seen pictures of Arizona, cactuses and lizards, the ruddy red landscape and hot blue sky. She pictures Luca with a clean backpack and a haircut, getting on a big yellow school bus and waving at her from the window. And then she conjures a third bedroom in that house for the sisters, Soledad's new baby, perhaps a girl. The smell of diapers, a bath in the kitchen sink. They're all eager to get clear of Lorenzo, Lydia most of all. So even though the shelter is comfortable and they are weary, and were he not here, it would be tempting to stay another night or two. In the morning, Luca, Lydia, Soledad, and Rebecca rouse themselves while it's still dark out. They are careful to creep past the men's bunk room without making a sound. They leave before dawn. Lydia feels a tremendous sense of urgency about getting out of Guadalajara, and it's not only because of Lorenzo. The city is a Venus flytrap, and she sees evidence all around as they rush through the indigo pre-dawn streets. Migrants come here with a momentum on their way to El Norte, and they may find a welcome, a slice of comfort, some relative safety away from the rails, so they stay an extra day to catch their breath. Then three more. Then 100. Look there, sleeping stretched out on a piece of cardboard in a disused corner of a parking lot, a shoeless mother and toddler in dirty clothing. There, with his eyes glazed and a brown paper bag of God knows what clutched tightly in his fist, a skinny teenage boy, track marked and bruised. There, there, and there. So many young girls tottering on heels in shadowy places, the whites of their eyes glowing brightly against the gloom. Lydia hustles Luca and the sisters away from the shelter and toward the tracks while the light around them grows toward sunrise. For Soledad and Rebecca, on the other hand, there's some increased measure of reluctance about this leg of their journey, because they learned from a woman at the shelter last night that they will soon cross into the state of Sinaloa, a place that's famous among migrants for two things: its expertise at disappearing girls and the vigor of its cartel. Still, there's no way to get to El Norte without passing through some place that's famous for those things, and they chose the Pacific route specifically because it's the most secure. So this is perhaps the most dangerous leg of the safest route. And in any case, the sooner they set out, the sooner they'll be past it. Soledad also has a new, increased sense of determination. What happened to Papi will not have been in vain. She is desperate to get to El Norte now, to make a life there that is good and golden, a life that will honor her family's sacrifices. So there's an urgent sense of disquiet among them as they move northwest along the tracks, listening all the time for the hopeful sound of a train at their backs. Lydia looks over her shoulder compulsively now, and when at length the train approaches, they board easily, without even much forethought or communication. That fact startles Lydia when she reflects on it. "We didn't even think about it," she says to Soledad, once she has Luca safely belted onto the grating. "We're becoming professionals," Soledad answers. But Lydia shakes her head. "No, we're becoming apathetic." Soledad frowns. "It's natural to get used to it, though, right? We adapt." Lydia touches a thick strand of Luca's hair that sticks out from beneath his father's baseball cap. It's too long, this hair. She coils one of the thick black curls around her finger, and in the tenderness of that act, she's momentarily transported back to her mother's garden. Leaning over Sebastian's lifeless body, the handle of the bent spatula digging into her knee, she has touched her husband's forehead, and the coarseness of his hair, still growing from its follicles, had tickled her wrist. Sebastian used shampoo with a scent of mint. A solitary sob rises from Lydia's bones, and is lost in the rumble of the train beneath her. She turns her eyes from Luca and looks at Soledad.
From now on, when we board, each time we board, I will remind you to be terrified, she says. And you remind me too. This is not normal.
This is not normal, Soledad nods.
The sky begins to brighten above them, and a ribbon of pale orange expands on the horizon. But it's still twilight where the tracks meet the earth. There's a handful of other migrants on top of the train, but it's not nearly as crowded as yesterday, and although the fact might be explained by the earliness of the hour, it serves to underscore Lydia's sense that Guadalajara has siphoned off some of their numbers. She feels her chest opening with something like relief as the train moves away from the city. A half hour north, the landscape is commandeered by miles of squat, spiky plants. They stretch into the distance along both sides of the tracks, their gray-green fronds like a million waving hands, and the train slows slightly at the outskirts of a town where the buildings are quaint and well-kept. Lydia notes the sweet, sticky aroma of fermenting agave plants, tequila. On the car behind them, two migrants climb down a side ladder and wait for a safe place to jump off. Luca tries to watch them, but the train turns and the men disappear, and Luca has to content himself without proof that they landed safely. He has to create that truth with only the determination of his mind. The train thunders on toward Tepic, toward Acaponeta, toward El Rosario. For a long time then, they pass nothing at all, just grass and dirt and trees and sky. The occasional building, a rare cow. It's pastoral, beautiful, and the morning air is fresh. Lydia feels a treacherous pang of smothered delight, a bewilderment of migrant as fleeting tourist, as if they're on vacation looking out across some exotic landscape. It's brief. Despite the growing distance between herself and Lorenzo, the peak of his presence remains. It's alarming that he found them so easily, so accidentally. He hadn't even been looking. But Javier is looking, with all his considerable resources, with all his connections. Lydia turns her face to the south, ridiculously, as if she'll see him standing there atop the train. As if he'll push his glasses up the bridge of his nose and approach her. It won't happen like that, she knows. When he comes for them, it won't be him, wearing a smile and a cardigan, clutching a volume of poetry to his chest. It will be some faceless assassin, some boy in a hoodie, cold in the dispatch of her death. El sicario won't feel anything when he delivers the bullet that murders her son. Lydia might be a hamster on a wheel. She knows their executioner might already be on this train, but she wills it to move faster regardless, that they might outrun the selfie of Lydia with Javier as it pings its way from phone to phone all the way across Mexico. Lydia shrinks between the sisters. She slips her fingers inside Sebastian's ring. At a tiny village surrounded by mango orchards, La Bestia crosses without notice into Sinaloa. Soledad is stretched out, her pack tucked beneath her as a pillow, and her fingers wrapped into the grating. Her face looks awash in a sickly gray. How are you feeling? Lydia asks. The vocabulary of her former life is inadequate now, but it's all she has. Soledad opens her mouth, but then closes it again without answering and shakes her head. When I was pregnant with Luca, olives helped with the nausea, she says quietly. Then her mind does a litany of counter-arguments. When I was pregnant with Luca, I was not 15 years old. When I was pregnant with Luca, I did not have to travel thousands of miles on top of a freight train. When I was pregnant with Luca, he was not conceived by rape.
Olives.
Soledad grimaces, readjusts her chin on her backpack, and closes her eyes. But it's no use. After two deep breaths, she lunges for the side of the train and vomits over the edge. Rebecca watches, her eyes wide with worry. Then she hands her pack to Luca and crawls across to her sister. She rubs the small of Soledad's back and waits for the retching to subside. There's a briny cut to the air as the tracks draw near the ocean. Mango groves give way to palm trees in sandy soil, and outside a tiny village, a couple dozen migrant men have made a large camp. They cheer when they see the train approaching, but the beast doesn't slow. It's moving too fast for them to board, so the men stand despondent, watching it thunder past. Luca waves and a few wave back. Most reclaim their positions in the scanty shade to rest while they wait for the next train, but one man decides to try. He runs alongside the tracks while the others watch. They shout and whoop at him, a lot of competing noise, conflicting advice. He manages to get one hand up on a passing ladder, but his legs can't keep up. His arm is snagged, but the legs hang down. The watching men yell louder and more frantically. Luca! Mami tries to draw his attention away, but he's leaning over to watch, transfixed by the dangling man. They all are. It's clear he won't make it, that he can't haul himself up from that position. One arm binds him to the velocity of La Bestia. They all hold their breath. The man's face is tipped up so Luca can see his expression, the moment he shifts from determination to acceptance. For a moment beyond that, he delays letting go. So Luca has the impression the man is savoring it, these final seconds when his life is intact. When at last his grip fails and he falls, there's still a hope, briefly, that he'll land clear of the tracks. That happens sometimes, a fluke of lucky physics and biology. But no, this man is sucked instantly beneath the wheels of the beast. His mangled screams can be heard above the sounds of the churning train. Luca looks back and sees the migrants gathering in a knot on the tracks behind them, assessing the pieces of the severed man. Lydia does not cry for that wounded man, but she does pray for him. She prays that he won't survive his mutilation, that merciful death comes quickly for him. More fervently, she prays that whatever impression the incident has on Luca, it won't cause him any further harm. Surely her son may soon reach a limit of what a resilient child might endure without triggering some permanent internal decay. "Don't worry, amorcito," she tells him. "That man will be fine." Luca protests. "He was in two pieces, mummy." Her voice is light. "That's what doctors are for." She feigns confidence in the way all mothers know how to do in front of their children. She wears the fierce maternal armor of deceit. She allows only a moment to pass before she changes the subject, turning to Rebecca. "So what will you girls do when you get to the border? You have a plan how to cross?" "Yes, our primo went last year into Arizona, and then he got a ride from there to Maryland. That's where he lives, and we're going to stay with him. We're using the same route, the same coyote." "How'd he find the coyote?" Lydia is constantly reminded that her education has no purchase here, that she has no access to the kind of information that has real currency on this journey. Among migrants, everyone knows more than she does. "How do you find a coyote? Make sure he's reputable, pay for your crossing, all without getting ripped off." Thankfully, Rebecca is flush with insight. "Loads of people from our village used him before. He was recommended, because you can't just pick any coyote. A lot of them will steal your money and then sell you to the cartel, you know?" Lydia has never met a coyote. It's possible she's never even met anyone who's met a coyote. "You should use our guy," Rebecca says. "Unless you already have one lined up." Lydia shakes her head. "We don't." Rebecca smiles.
so we can go together. Mi primo César, he says this guy is the best. It took them only 2 days of walking, and then somebody picked them up in a camper van on the other side and drove them to Phoenix. Gave him bus tickets from there to wherever they were going. It's a lot of money, but he's safe.
How much money? Lydia asks.
Rebecca looks to Soledad, who's still lying down, her head resting in her folded arms. Rebecca continues rubbing her sister's back. How much, Sole?
Soledad answers without lifting her head or opening her eyes. 4,000 each.
Lydia is startled by the sum. I thought it would be much more than that, like 10,000 pesos at least.
Dollars, Soledad says, her voice muffled by the sleeve of her shirt. $4,000.
Dios santo.
Lydia does a quick intake of breath. She accepts dollars in the bookstore, so she's familiar with the typical exchange rates, but not in these quantities. She strains to do the math in her head.
It's a lot of money. But they have enough. They have plenty. They will even have a small sum left to get them started on the other side.
But then she remembers the padre's pep talk in Celaya.
Every single one of you will be robbed. Everyone. If you make it to El Norte, you will arrive penniless. That's a guarantee.
But it's good, anyway, to have a plan, to look beyond what they might eat today or where they might sleep tonight. Lydia doesn't feel ready for it, but she's beginning to consider the future. She's definitely not ready to look back, though, and she hopes she may accomplish one without necessitating the other.
So where do you meet this coyote?
He's expecting you? She asks Rebecca.
Yes, his name is El Chacal.
Of course it is, Lydia thinks. Why would a coyote be named Roberto or Luis or José when he can be named the Jackal?
And he works out of Nogales.
When we get there, we call his cell phone. Look. Rebecca loosens a rainbow wristband she wears on her left arm and sticks her finger into a tiny hole on the inside. From there, she unrolls a scrap of paper with the coyote's phone number on it.
Good, Lydia nods.
Okay. So now they have a solid plan. It's amazing that riding on the top of a freight train can become boring, but it's true. The tedium is spectacular. The chugging of the engine and the squeal of the metal are so constant that the migrants no longer hear those things. At towns where the train slows or stops, migrants get off, migrants get on, and they continue. The sun hikes high into the sky and glares down on them until their skin is so hot they can smell it, a little charred, and the brightness of the light bleaches the colors out of the landscape. They pass through Mazatlán without stopping, where the tracks run alongside the ocean for a while, and the existence of sand there and the blueness of the sea remind Luca of home, which makes him feel obliterated instead of cheered. He's glad when they turn inland and leave the beach behind. But then it's back to hours of tedium, blended brown and green and gray, so it's almost a welcome diversion when a few miles outside Culiacán, the monotony is broken by screaming. A lone voice repeats the words over and over like a siren.
La migra! La migra!
All around them, migrants grab their things quickly. Some don't even bother with that. They look once at the dust trails kicked up by the tires of the approaching trucks. They choose the opposite side of the train, and they bail.
Come on, Soledad, wake up, Rebecca says, her voice tight with panic. We have to go.
The train is slowing but hasn't stopped, and the men on top aren't waiting. They scatter. They bolt.
A la mierda con esto,
Soledad curses, slinging her pack onto her shoulders.
What's happening, mommy?
Luca asks. In theory, La Migra is no threat to Lydia and Luca. As Mexican nationals, they cannot be deported back to Guatemala or El Salvador. And unlike most of their fellow migrants, they aren't in the country illegally. They're committing only the minor infraction of riding the train. So perhaps it's only the pervasive panic all around them,
Perhaps it's contagious. But no, Lydia just knows. She can tell that los agentes de la migra, in their uniforms, are not here to enforce law and order. She knows by the bone-deep fear born only of instinct that she can't rely on their citizenship now to protect them. They are in mortal danger. She can feel it in her pores, in her hair. The trucks converge like pack animals. The men inside are masked and armed. Lydia scrabbles frantically at the buckle on Luca's belt, but her hands are shaking and she has to try 3 times before she can free him.
Mami?
Luca's voice is rising in pitch. Hers is low. We have to run. Chapter 21. There are 3 trucks, all black and white with enormous roll bars, and together they speed across the roadless dirt and sidle up beside the tracks, spewing gravel and dust behind them. There are at least 4 agentes standing in the back of each truck, plus more inside, and they're all kitted out like they're going to war. Luca stares at them with his mouth open. They wear boots and knee pads and helmets and giant studded Kevlar vests and gloves and dark black visors so you can't see their eyes, and their faces are entirely covered by black balaclavas. Each one of them has weapons strapped all over his body and a really large gun slung diagonally across his chest. And Luca can't even begin to imagine what they'd need all that weaponry for. Just to catch a few migrants? And then he also thinks it would be impossible to tell the difference, in all that gear, between an agente federal de migración and a narcotraficante in disguise. And Luca